With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hey, Kev. Thanks for having me on again. My name's Sam Karp. I'm a Crystal Palace fan. You can find me on Twitter at Sam_Karp and some of my work for the Eagles Beak fan site.
Hi, thanks for having me, Kevin. I'm Steve McGugan. I'm a Spurs fan from Belfast. I'm currently in sunny Baltimore. You can get me at Steve McGugan, all one word.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining me today, guys. Excited to talk about all things Premier League with you, except Arsenal. And this isn't because it's a Tottenham thing, but the last three shows we've discussed Tottenham, Arsenal, and United in order, talking about them either taking the step forward or falling off, all of that stuff. So I didn't just want to get into another here's your weekly top four update. Arsenal, obviously two very big wins. Tottenham, a very disappointing loss. Manchester United, two disappointing losses. But we will continue that third with Manchester United, because last week it was about whether or not they were going to make the top four. It seems like with 1 week, two losses to historic rivals, they're probably out of that hunt. But they also took a step towards their future with the hiring of Erik ten Hag. And I was just curious your guys' thoughts on that appointment and if, of the reported options, you think ten Hag was the best option for them right now.
Yeah, I guess so. Although it's kind of like, I never really knew how long that shortlist was for United. It always felt like it was a choice between ten Hag and Pochettino. It only ever felt like it was going to be one of those two. And in many ways, I think they've actually done quite well to convince a manager as well thought of as Ten Hag to come and join a club that is as kind of, you know, in as much disarray as United are at the moment. I know that, you know, despite the current state that they're in, there is still a certain allure about managing Manchester United, as, you know, Paul Scholes and Roy Keane like to remind us every week, you know, the whole this is Manchester United we're talking about narrative. But I can't imagine too many managers would kind of look at that, look at the way the club is structured at the moment and think it's an attractive job to walk into. Especially when you hear some of the things that have come out even just in recent days, obviously about a disjointed dressing room, which Scholes let slip that, well, yesterday, I think it was on DAZN, he was talking about it. He said he'd had a conversation with Jesse Lingard and he said, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying that the dressing room's a mess at the moment. And I was kind of listening, thinking, I think he definitely would mind you giving away what he said in a private conversation. But yeah, there was that. And then you have Rangnick as well, the current man in charge, basically saying that the club needs to be gutted all the way through. You know, I think he likened it to open heart surgery the other day in terms of the rebuild that needs to happen. And, you know, I think that's kind of, that's the problem, really. You can talk about whether Ten Hag is, you know, the right manager or not, if he's the best, sort of the best candidate they could have got. But you have to ask whether the club really is structured in a way at the moment for any manager to go there and be successful. You know, you just look at what's happened since Sir Alex Ferguson left. You know, David Moyes couldn't do it. Louis van Gaal couldn't do it. Jose Mourinho couldn't do it. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer couldn't do it. And there are plenty of people more qualified to talk about Manchester United than me, who watch them probably on a weekly basis, who have noted that really things aren't necessarily going to change on the pitch until they change off it. So that's kind of, I think that's going to be the big challenge for Ten Hag, really, you know, to try and reverse this downward spiral that United seems to be on at the moment, to try and kind of, you know, flush out that toxicity that just seems to exist around the place. And also, I think he is still a little bit of an unknown coming into this environment. We know how well he has done at Ajax, their exploits in the Champions League, and he is kind of a sort of, you know, I guess he's kind of what you'd describe as like a philosophy manager in a way as well. But United just, United is an entirely different institution to Ajax, you know, with different politics, lots of outside noise, lots of, as I mentioned already, you know, Keane scores, lots of old figureheads kind of having their say on the situation. So he's going to kind of have to manage that coming from a club in Ajax where there is a really good system in place to ensure consistent success. He's stepping out of that to a club where, you know, which seems to have kind of no direction whatsoever at the moment, not just kind of on the pitch, but also off it. You know, the ownership seems really detached. And that just seems to be a massive, massive issue. So I don't know, to me, they kind of... It feels like with United, they're at a similar juncture to where Liverpool were at in, I want to say kind of like the late noughties, sort of early 2010s, possibly, when they had, who were the owners before FSG? I forget their names, but you know, there was a really toxic atmosphere around the place. And then that kind of changed and they brought in Klopp and everything was kind of structured for him to succeed. So I think United are kind of probably hoping that Ten Hag can be their Klopp style appointment. But again, Klopp coming into Liverpool, you even think about Guardiola going into City, you knew that everything was kind of set up at those clubs for those managers to succeed. And you sort of still see that today. So the question really, you know, is that the same for Ten Hag in United? I'm really not sure, but I guess that's probably what we're going to find out.
Yeah, I totally agree with all of that. And that's actually a really good point about the same stage of development that Liverpool were before Klopp arrived. I think that's the challenge, I think, for Ten Hag is to, that's the bar that has been set. Like a lot of people from Belfast, my dad is a Manchester United fan, which makes when we watch the games between our two teams very interesting. But he is... on the one hand, he's been a United fan for 40 years, and he's basically, Ferguson can do no wrong as far as my dad is concerned. But he also realizes that maybe it's time to move on from the expectations that went along with Fergie's reign. It's interesting that the obvious expectations now for United fans of a quick turnaround, I think, are going to just play into the additional pressure that Ten Hag's going to be under. And changing that mood that Sam spoke about in the club, that would be a huge ask, you know, for any incoming manager, as I say, especially with the pressure that the fans put on. There are always plenty of what ifs when it comes to being the boss of a team that are still one of the biggest names in football, even if they are, you know, as you said, more of a project now than they have been for a few seasons. But even in that context, it's hard to believe, isn't it, that Brendan Rodgers was actually the front runner at one stage, but then, you know, stranger things have happened. I mean, obviously, Poch was in the frame, and it was really interesting, I think, to see the reaction of the PSG fans to their title victory yesterday. And I do think that Poch would have been a good choice to oversee the kind of rebuild that they're going to need. I'm not sure that a partnership with Rangnick as director of football would have been what Poch would have wanted, but I think certainly in terms of the way he nurtures young players and that sort of thing, he would have done a good job. Zidane, Diego Simeone, I guess they were also spoken about at various points, but I can't help but think back, and Kevin, you and I have talked about this before, to when United beat us 3-0 at the Lane just before Christmas, in what turned out to be Nuno's last game in charge, and what effectively then became loser gets Conte game, and how things might have been different for both teams if that result had gone differently. So obviously a big challenge for Ten Hag coming in, and interestingly, I thought it seems similar to the immediate challenge that Tuchel had when he arrived at Chelsea. You know, sort out the defense first before you do anything else, but realistically, it's hard to imagine United being turned around as quickly as Tuchel was able to do at Stamford Bridge, because you know the quality of the players were there. It was just a matter of organising them differently, and I think there's certainly more structural work to be done at United. But the upside for them, I think, what they have going for them next year is, even if they're not going to be able to offer Champions League football, they're still one of that very small universe of European clubs that are wealthy enough to, if not get their top targets, then at least affect the market for the leading players. So I think Ten Hag's prospects for the sort of squad overhaul that Rangnick has talked about and that the fans are expecting, I think it's not as gloomy as a lot of United fans might fear. So I think we'll just have to wait and see. And obviously, as I say, the defence is his immediate priority on the pitch, because I saw a stat the other day that just said this is only the second time since 1979 that they've conceded 50 goals in a league season. And that's despite having De Gea, who's, you know, still one of the best keepers in the Premiership. So obviously we know where the structural problems are. But I think beyond that, and Sam hinted at it, there's a general lack of confidence and a sense of collective responsibility, I think, that you don't normally associate with Man United teams. So I think alongside any positional changes, Ten Hag's going to have to get to grips with that mindset first and foremost. And as you say, you know, he's certainly worked wonders at Ajax, but you know, the jury's going to be out for a while at Man U, as it would have been for any coach, I think.
Yeah, I think those are all some really good points, and both of you kind of speaking of the kind of hierarchy of Manchester United within the Premier League and its history. Is why you get the crazy thing of Ten Hag's assistant at Ajax being offered the Ajax job and the assistantship under Ten Hag at United. And it's a choice he's trying to make. Like, you'd think you would want to take that step to be the manager of a place you're already familiar with. And we all know, like, there is a little bit of a question mark surrounding Ajax managers just because it is such a strong culture and system at the club, from scouting to ownership to management. Everything's just so cohesive that it's very easy to operate in that system. And he could have been Ten Hag in 2 to 3 years, as we've seen a lot of Ajax managers kind of come in, get that clout, and then kind of move on. But yeah, that there is still that pull. That's certainly true. Steve kind of just talked about what might happen in the summer and the Rangnick quotes, which was there could be like 10 incomings, which would be obviously insane. Of the regularly starting 11, Sam, how many do you think are still going to have a place next year? Or do you think they really are just going to have this like massive philosophical overhaul of the squad?
Yeah, it's quite hard to say, really. I mean, when you think about this season, you'd say the only players that really come out of it with too much credibility are probably, and even when Steve mentioned there, I didn't actually realize that 50 goals stat, but you know, you'd say De Gea has probably still been their player of the season, possibly up there with, I guess you'd say, Ronaldo. And even Fred, I think Fred at times has been pretty good. Obviously, Fred's usually been a bit of a scapegoat for United, but I think he's kind of stepped up this season a little bit more. But I think it's pretty unrealistic to expect there to be a huge overhaul in personnel in just one summer. Obviously, we know that some high-profile players such as Pogba will be leaving. And as Steve alluded to already, it's obviously the defence that needs the biggest overhaul, I think. Especially, I think they've got some good centre-backs, but I think in the full-back areas is where they really need to kind of upgrade. And I say that as a Crystal Palace fan who has been watching, you know, through the gaps in his fingertips at Aaron Wan-Bissaka this season, who just appears to have kind of, you know, lost all confidence and just looks a little bit out of his depth now, unfortunately, and kind of his development is really, really stifled at United. I don't know whether that's to do with sort of the environment around him or just something going on with him, but yeah, that's been quite sad to see. But I think it's also important to remember that there are still some really promising young players at the club, and Ten Hag, coming from Ajax, will be used to developing those sorts of talents, and you have to imagine that that's something that will have appealed to United in appointing him. I wouldn't expect a huge overhaul in personnel in just one summer, but I imagine we will see hints in the coming months at the direction they're going to go with the recruitment strategy. I'm not sure what capacity Rangnick's going to end up staying on in, if at all, but you imagine that if he is working with Ten Hag on who United do bring in, then the kind of profile of signing is going to be a lot different to what we've seen in recent years, where it has just been a case of, you know, sign the biggest names, the most talented individuals, throw them all on the pitch and just hope that it works. You know, kind of the if you throw a load of shit at the wall, eventually some of it will stick. So apology for my language, but you know, that's kind of what it's felt like. Whereas I think there'll be a little bit more strategic thinking behind who they get in this summer, with a kind of, you know, thinking about maybe this player isn't necessarily going to be transformational in the 2022-23 season, but further down the line, they're going to be someone who really contributes. And that just that's another thing which kind of it speaks a little bit to what Steve was saying before about, you know, the level of expectation that's going to be on Ten Hag. Is the United fan base one that's going to be prepared to be patient? Because I think that with a manager like him coming in, there is going to have to be that patience for, because even going back to the sort of Klopp comparison I made at the start, you know, he didn't exactly hit the ground running straight away. It took time for Liverpool to become what they are today. I mean, people always mock when Liverpool famously drew 2-2 at home to West Brom, wasn't it? And Klopp leading his players over to the Kop. That got mocked at the time, but you know, Klopp always sort of alludes back to it and says, you know, that was still kind of a moment, that was something. And you know, I don't know whether United fans will have that same level of patience, because I think if they do, then it is something that can turn into something great, and it is something that can succeed, but they are just going to kind of have to ride it for a little bit. And kind of, if they are not necessarily making the signings that they have been in recent seasons, they're going to kind of have to have patience with players that they maybe haven't had in the past.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And Kevin, I think that Ajax assistant coach that you were mentioning, he's probably weighing up exactly how much he wants to work with Steve McLaren.
Yeah, could be. And also looking at the size of the checks and the difference between them, which is obviously absolutely fair.
Sam made a really important point there, I think, about the defense and the confidence. And I think confidence is the key thing. And clearly, when your club captain and your main center back doesn't seem to be playing with a great deal of confidence at the moment, then that just radiates out to every other player. And so, I mean, I'm not suggesting that they're going to get rid of Maguire, but I just think that is the mindset that he's going to have to address.
Yeah, definitely a rough week for him, and we won't get into the, you know, threats and all that stuff. But hey, if you're listening, you know, don't. We assume that if you're listening to the show, you probably aren't the kind of person that's emailing bomb threats to players. But if you're even thinking about it, maybe just don't. We'll move next to Newcastle. Also, we're in the news this week with more reports of sports washing, which I don't really know why there are reports. It just is what's happening at the club. But we'll stick to the football side here and leave that to more educated people than ourselves on that particular issue. But I wanted to talk about their performances on the pitch, because they've now jumped up to 10th. They've won 4 of their last 4, which is obviously impressive, all but ensuring that they're going to be in the Premier League next season. I don't think you're going to need 40 points this year. You're definitely not going to need the 43 where they currently sit. And I was just thinking about the differences between what happened in like the month or so after Eddie Howe came in to then obviously bringing in a lot of players in January, some of whom got hurt, like Kieran Trippier. Chris Wood hasn't exactly been scoring goals, but he's given kind of a focal point to the team. Bruno Guimaraes finally stepping up and looking like the absolute, you know, bargain purchase that he was in January. I'm aware that it was 40 million, but for the player that he currently is and could be, still think that was an excellent deal. But I was curious what you made of Eddie Howe's performance as manager thus far, and what percentage of that success do you think is just the fact that they spent a crap ton in January and likely will again in the summer?
Yeah, this is another one of those conversations which seems to dominate Twitter a lot. So when Newcastle tweet about another win at the end of a game, all the comments are kind of just filled with, you know, blood money. Oh, you spent £100 million. That's the only reason that you're good. And I think it's doing Howe a bit of a disservice to say that Newcastle's progress has solely been down to the money that they spent in that transfer window. And I say that as someone who has never really taken to Howe. I wasn't a massive fan of him when he was at Bournemouth. There was chat of he was obviously kind of in the frame to take over from Hodgson when Palace were looking for a new manager, and I kind of always used to buy into that sort of PE teacher vibe that people used to throw at him. But I think he's probably proved quite a few people wrong, especially because they had quite a rocky start under him as well. You know, it wasn't they didn't sort of hit the ground running straight away. And as you kind of say, Kev, you look at the signings that they made, while they were certainly players that you would sort of expect to improve a team in the position Newcastle found themselves in, you know, Chris Wood, for example, Matt Target at fullback, and then obviously Trippier, who, as you say, has been injured quite a lot. And I guess Guimarães was the kind of only sort of proper marquee sort of signing, I guess you could say. But I don't think too many of them were the sort of transformational signings that would take the club from being, you know, I guess a lower mid-table side to where they are now. I think, yeah, they've obviously helped. The squad's a lot stronger. But I think you have to look at the improvements in players that were already there as a kind of as a measure of the impact that, that Howe has had on the team. So you look at Joe Linton as an obvious candidate, just couldn't buy a goal when Bruce was there. Just couldn't, just seemed like a really ineffective player. It just didn't look like he was cut out for the Premier League when Steve Bruce was the manager. And all of a sudden he's transformed him into this guy who can play across the midfield, can play up front, scored two good goals yesterday again. Almiron, who got his annual goal against Palace the other night, even guys like Emil Kraft in the defence. You know, these are players who weren't really doing much under Bruce, but have really raised their game under Howe, and I think that's quite a good measure of the impact that a manager has. And yeah, I guess you could obviously make the argument that the conditions under which Howe is managing Newcastle are much more favourable than the ones that than the cards that were dealt to Bruce. But this version of Newcastle is kind of, you know, almost unrecognisable to the one we saw at the start of the season. They play on the front foot. They go out to breathe life into games rather than suck it out of them. And, you know, the players look like they enjoy it. So, I think you have to attribute a lot of it to Howe's management, to be honest. And yeah, it'll just be interesting to see if they can kind of carry the momentum that they've got at the moment into next season.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I agree with that. A couple more stats. Only Liverpool have picked up more points in 2022 than Newcastle. This is the first time since May 2014 that Newcastle have been as high as ninth this far into the season, despite spending 150 days in the relegation zone. And you have to say Howe has done an excellent job, really. But in a way, maybe he's been helped a bit by the fact that some of the other teams around him have been consistently inconsistent. You know, if you look at the likes of Brighton, Southampton, Leicester, even Villa, Wolves, they just haven't been able to put together good enough runs to consolidate their place. And as Kevin sort of pointed to, with the end result, if you look at the table and with the various games in hand, you know, everyone from Wolves in eighth down to Villa in 15th, you'd be hard pressed to actually predict the final order in that group. So I think for Newcastle, it would be a huge achievement if they were to overtake Wolves and finish in eighth. But I think 9th, 10th, or 11th is probably a more realistic viewpoint, especially given Leicester's games in hand. But I think either way, I think we're agreed that the Toon fans will probably see that as a satisfactory half season's work, and the expectation again that sets them up in a decent position for next year. And again, it'll be interesting to see what Eddie Howe can do with a budget and in a situation where you know, finishing mid table is seen as a triumph, as he was at Bournemouth, obviously. And you know, you mentioned the signings, Trippier, obviously, with all the, you know, the lingering Tottenham regret that goes along with that. And obviously, Guimarães is a terrific player, it seems. The Chris Wood signing, I thought, was very interesting in that not only the competition for places helped get the best out of Joe Linton and Alan Saint-Maximin, I think, as well. But it also, of course, removed whatever goal-scoring contribution Wood might have made to a potential relegation rival at the same time in Burnley. So, and I guess, you know, Burnley are the other big story today after the results today and the intensifying pressure that's on Lampard and Everton, and also, I think, Jesse Marsh at Leeds. And that final relegation place, now that, you know, Newcastle are no longer in it, but That final relegation place is turning out to be, you know, just as competitive as the race for fourth place. And it's strange how the sort of run-ins are intertwined, because I noticed the Leeds have to play Arsenal, Chelsea and Man City. Everton have Chelsea and Arsenal. Burnley have to come to us. And I suppose of those three, you'd probably say Burnley maybe have the easier of the run-ins. But it's never easy to play against a team that's desperate for points, even if you think you're safe yourself. But certainly in terms of what Howe has accomplished, I would really like to know what his relationship with John Joe Shelby is, because, I mean, from a playing perspective, obviously, because it seems like whoever comes into a team like that where there's a dominant player on the park, and I think the closest man you have to that is probably McTominay. And so the relationship that you know, Howe has with Shelby to execute his plan on the field, Ten Hag's going to have to develop that similar kind of relationship with McTominay as well as Maguire as well. So, I think that the individual dynamics of the players who are there are actually probably more important than the relationships of with the manager and players that might come in.
Yeah, I think those are all really good points. And I just did some quick math. And in the 1 month that Howe was manager before that January window, 0.29 points per game, since January, 0.64. But Steve, you basically already said that nobody outside of Liverpool have picked up more points since January. So yeah, I think it's probably too small of a sample size, probably both sides, to be honest, to draw much from. But did find it interesting that it leapt that high after that window. You guys obviously talked about a lot of the players that they've already brought in and the fact that they'll probably buy more in the summer. What are the expectations from us, which is obviously just a big group of neutrals, about where we think Newcastle will finish next year with a full off-season, with a full summer of buying players? Hopefully Eddie Howe doesn't just try to get more Liverpool players like he did when he was at Bournemouth. I'm not sure Divock Origi is going to be your guy, although he did score again today, as per, in a big match in the final minutes. I was just curious, are we thinking like Europa League? Are we thinking they're going to jump all the way into the top four discussion, or do we think they're kind of going to stay in this like 8 to 12 space for another year or two?
Yeah, that stat that Steve brought up is crazy. Actually, my dad mentioned that to me yesterday about the them picking up second most points in 2022, and the kind of thing that, do you remember the last team that probably did something like that from being relegation threatened to kind of just surging up the league? That's probably Leicester, and then they won the league the season after, didn't they? So I hope that doesn't happen, because as much as I am kind of crediting the job that Howe's done, there is always part of me watching Newcastle that sort of thinks, you know, this is something I don't like this. There's something I don't like about it. I think in terms of next season, to be honest, that's all going to depend on what they do this summer, really. For everything I just said, I think the squad is probably still a mid-table squad, the kind of basically what Steve was saying in terms of eighth to 14th, that kind of area. And I don't think this wave that they're currently riding is going to last all the way through next season. You know, there will kind of hit some bumps in the road under Howe. So I suppose the way I'd kind of look at it is that after making those signings in January that were, you know, really did strengthen the squad, were pretty much designed to solidify their place in the Premier League and just ensure that relegation wasn't going to be a thing. I guess the question is, can they make more of those signings like Guimaraes, like Trippier, who are used to competing at the top end of the table, who are used to success, who are used to winning games more often than not? And that's probably what's going to, those are the sort of caliber of players who are going to push them on. So I think obviously it sort of goes without saying that the days of Newcastle being a perennial relegation struggler are behind us, which is probably something that would alarm some of those teams that typically finish outside that sort of top eight, top nine, because you could always kind of count on Newcastle being one of those sides that you could drag into it. And just, you know, when one of those teams kind of leaves that group, it does look an awful lot smaller. So the sort of pool of teams that can go down now feels like it's shrunk quite a bit with this investment that's gone into Newcastle. I think I'd be surprised if we see them, if we do see them kind of pushing into that sort of top six or seven conversation. I think there's still a way for them to catch up with teams, even like sort of, you know, your Leicesters and your West Hams who have really developed in recent years. So I'd say I think probably mid-table again is kind of where I'd place them next season.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's probably, as you say, they're probably a pretty solid sort of top half team now. And I think there is going to be pressure from the fans to use the resources, to spend the money on a flash signing, a big name signing, just to prove they can. But I can't see, from an agent perspective, I can't see anybody taking a punt with a player, especially a younger player, until they've established themselves as a perennial Champions League challenger. So I think it's going to be a couple of seasons before you see. I think next season will be the consolidation phase, where they'll bring in a couple of veterans, a couple of people who know how to run a game properly. And then the following season, you might see them splash the cash a little bit more in terms of trying to, because some of the things that the Newcastle fans have been saying, you know, the expectation that we're now in PSG's league, we're now in Man City's league, I think that's just nonsensical. And I think if the club is being run responsibly and with an eye on building the platform on which they're going to move into a top four conversation, then that won't happen overnight. So, yeah, I think, much as I hate to disappoint the Newcastle fans, I can't see them really, you know, splashing out on a big name signing next season. But what do I know?
A lot. But thanks for asking. I agree with all of that. All right, we'll wrap up this first section talking about crossing. So both your clubs, Palace and Tottenham, rank in the bottom 10 in both total and accurate crosses. And I was wondering if you thought at your club, if that's more of a tactical or formational choice by the manager, or just a lack of quality crossers in the squad?
Yeah, on paper, it's maybe a little bit surprising when I saw this stat, because, you know, Palace do play with a front three. They have a big man going through the middle in Mateta, and then usually have two of Elise, Zaha, Ayew and Edouard either side. But then think about it a little bit more. Palace really aren't a very big team ourselves. You know, you think back to the start of the season when we really struggled with set pieces. I generally think a big part of that was just down to the fact that our players aren't very tall, which sounds a very simplistic way of looking at it, but it was quite noticeable that the other players were just bigger, and it just kind of it did make a difference, and we kind of had to think about a different way of defending set pieces. But so, like, kind of thinking in those terms, it probably wouldn't be a very good tactic for us to be putting in a lot of crosses. And, you know, maybe with the exception of Elise, crossing probably isn't really what you'd associate with those other sort of wide players that I mentioned. You know, Zaha kind of likes to cut in a little bit more. Ayew the same. And then Edouard is sort of, he's played out wide, but he's not necessarily a winger. So, and it's not really something you'd associate massively with our fullbacks either. You know, they're a little bit more defensive minded naturally, I think. It's not too surprising to see that stat, to be honest. And I think it also speaks a little bit to the change in style that Vieira has implemented. You know, I think back to last season, even the last few seasons really under Hodgson, and the plan was always to get the ball wide to Andros Townsend or Wilfried Zaha. In fact, they even did a montage when Townsend left of all of the crosses that he'd put into Benteke for goals, which kind of speaks, it's kind of, they weren't really trying to hide the fact that that was the tactic. I think historically that's kind of been more of a focus for us, but this season it's been a case of, you know, the front three interchanges a lot more. While Mateta obviously is a big guy and is decent in the air, he's actually really, really good with his feet as well. And a lot of his goals have actually come from him sort of coming onto pullbacks and that kind of thing and arriving late in the box. So rather than kind of attacking aerial crosses, it's been more of sort of doing stuff with his feet really. And, you know, generally throughout the team, there's a greater focus on possession too. We try to pass the ball through the lines, play balls in behind. So I think, yeah, it speaks a little bit more to the way that Vieira wants to play, and it, yeah, kind of points to the changes that we've made this season. So, So yeah, an interesting stat definitely, but kind of when I started to pick through it, I think I can kind of see the reason that we are kind of down there in that area.
Yeah, well, unlike Sam, that stat didn't surprise me at all when it comes to Tottenham, and you know why, Kev, as well. I think whatever happens, we're going to be looking at both sides of the pitch in terms of effective wingbacks, since we just haven't had any consistency of service from those positions. I mean, the situation we have right now with Doherty's enforced absence, just at a point when he was starting to, you know, make a real contribution, I think, and started to integrate into that system a lot better, means that, you know, Emerson Royal's back in the lineup, like it or not, and because we have no other options. And then
I do not, for the record.
Okay, fair enough. His distribution is just shocking. I mean, we can't continue without addressing that. And then, you know, that in turn has had a knock-on effect, I think, on Kulusevski, because he's having to drop deeper with Royal plays behind him. And obviously, thankfully, the upside with Kulusevski is he covers a lot of ground anyway. But I think it constrains him when he has to sort of play that deep. But I do think Doherty is obviously the preferred option there of what we have available. And on the left-hand side, you know, Reguilon, much as I love him, his end result has pretty much always been disappointing. I mean, and I would have to say that time's probably running out for Ryan Sessegnon to impress Conte sufficiently to be in the mix for a starting position next season. So, I just mentioned Kieran Trippier when we were talking about Newcastle signings, and it is hard to imagine, really, that he wasn't at least on our radar at that time. You know, he would have been a known quantity for us for sure, and it would have gone, I think, some way at least to plugging that gap and addressing the fact that we have gone down in quality since Kyle Walker left. And I understand why we sold Walker. The price was, you know, it was an overinflated price, I think, for that moment. But and you know, there's an argument about selling to one of your top four rivals at the time, which you know, we can argue about. But we thought at that point that Trippier was going to turn out to be better consistently than he turned out to be, which is why he ended up leaving. But I do think that would have plugged a gap for us if we'd known he would have been available to come back. I mean, obviously, there are other issues around how we create chances and how much we rely on Kane, for example. You know, the idea of Kane dropping deep and not being able to feed himself is a huge issue for us. But the wing back situation is definitely, I think, a more obvious one that is going to need addressing, given the way Conte is committed to playing.
Yeah, that all obviously depends on Conte being there next year, but we'll get to that in a second. We'll leave that there for now, and then we'll be back with club specific questions for each of our guests.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
All right, and we are back. Sam, we'll start off with you. I figure we need to touch on the cup match. Obviously, you actually got to go, your first one in a while. You were telling us right before we hit record. And I was just curious if you're more pleased that you've made a deep cup run, more disappointed with the result, and what the atmosphere was like on the day.
Yeah, it's very rare that Crystal Palace kind of get to get to feature in an occasion like that. So it's always a really, really good day, irrespective of the football. And I'm sure a lot of Palace fans had a similar experience to me. You kind of, you know, get up to London fairly early, go out, have a few drinks. By the time the game kicks off, you're kind of seeing a couple of footballs rather than one. But yeah, it was a really fun day. And, you know, Palace fans always bring a lot of colour to Wembley, as we did in 2016, I think the last time was, when we got even closer than this season to winning. Obviously, that extra time goal from Jesse Lingard for United at that point. But yeah, it was, to be honest, the footballing side of it felt like a little bit of an anticlimax, to be honest, and it felt like a little bit of a missed opportunity, because it did feel a little bit like Chelsea were there for the taking. There was you never kind of go into these games as a Palace fan expecting to win, but kind of given the run that we'd been on in the build up to that, obviously had held City to a 0-0 draw, had kind of, you know, made a win against Arsenal look fairly routine, and that was an in-form Arsenal that we beat at Selhurst Park just a couple of weeks before the semi-final. There was a really good feeling going into it, whereas you kind of felt with Chelsea, it was sort of the opposite. You know, they'd been pummeled by Brentford at Stamford Bridge. They'd just gone out of the chat. They'd obviously played extremely well in Madrid, but just been knocked out of the Champions League. So you felt like they were a little bit more vulnerable than a Chelsea side you would usually come up against. And it just didn't really feel like we laid too much of a glove on them, to be honest. We set up completely differently to how we have all season as well. We played a 3-5-2, which we kind of, it impressed me in the way that we sort of moved to that. You know, the first half we contained Chelsea pretty well without really threatening them too much ourselves. And then kind of the second half, we just sort of, Vieira made a fairly strange substitution early on where he took off Mateta for Ayew, and kind of everything just kind of, from that stage on, the ball just kept coming back, and we didn't really have a focal point anymore. And there was just became a little bit of an air of inevitability about it. And yeah, so it was fairly disappointing. Both goals as well, we kind of shot ourselves in the foot a little bit. Mitchell lost the ball in a pretty dangerous area for the first one. Loftus cheek shot got a bit of a deflection and flies in, and from that point on it all felt fairly routine for Chelsea, to be honest. So yeah, obviously really good to have got that far, especially in Vieira's first season. I'm not sure many Palace fans would have expected us to reach a semi-final of a cup competition in his debut season, so it was kind of a bonus in that sense. So it's hard to be disappointed, but at the same time there is kind of this lingering feeling of, you know, what if we did have a little bit more of a go and kind of play with that sort of high intensity press that has kind of caused some of those top teams a problem so far this season.
Gotcha. And then Steve, we'll come to you to talk a little bit about Tottenham. Things looked really good 2 weeks ago, really bad 4 weeks ago, really good 6 weeks ago. This has kind of been the pattern of the race for the top four with Tottenham and Arsenal and United. It seems the latter is now probably out of that conversation. But why do you think Tottenham have suddenly started to struggle after being the highest scoring team in 2022 to suddenly not having a shot on target for two consecutive matches?
I don't know, Kevin. Honestly, you use the word why. I mean, it's inexplicable. Well, it's not inexplicable. I got to tell you, I was dreading going on Spurs Twitter after yesterday's game, you know, so much that I went to the Garden Center. And sure enough, when I came back on later, it was exactly what I was expecting. The sense of uncertainty and fragility in this team at the moment is being mirrored, as it always does, by the fans. We're a pretty fickle bunch to start with, I think, and this roller coaster of inconsistency that has basically summed up Spurs' performances at the moment is just guaranteed to pile on the pressure on social media. But, you know, we can't get away from the fact that we didn't record a shot on target in either of the past two games, and we just absolutely lost whatever groove we were in a few games ago, for God's sake. And that brought to mind that this pronounced change in how we are. It brought to mind a time before your time, Kevin. I was at a game at the Lane, and we were beating Bolton 2-0. And it was a Boxing Day game, and the big screen flashed up a picture of Naeem, who was in the crowd, and the the team's concentration was completely broken, and the next thing you know, we draw 2-2. And it was a hugely Spursy, a legendary Spursy moment, and this season has been one of those highs and lows, kind of, you know, legendary Spursy season. And you can't address this without talking about Harry. And, you know, clearly he's the talisman, and obviously a lot depends on his mindset off the pitch as well as his dip on it. I mean, you know, did flying out to the Masters Golf affect his training rhythm? Yes, probably, but it should be out of his system by now, you'd think. And frankly, all the other players who didn't go on holiday that weekend have also come up short in the last couple of games. You know, given the contrast between the nothing less than sublime the way we were playing against Newcastle and the Brighton game, you know, just shows how lacking we are when three players all have an off day at the same time. And certainly I think the importance of this is Kane is as central as Conte, I think, to what happens with the team and maybe even more broadly with the club and its ownership, you know, for next season and beyond. So that's actually why it's slightly more worrying than just the outcome of individual games. I mean, some people think we expect too much of him. And there was a Barney Roney piece in The Guardian yesterday, I think, or the other day, that I kind of alluded to about Kane's role playing as both a striker and an attacking midfielder at the same time. And that's, you know, obviously something we've known about for a while, but it goes back to the fact that we haven't really replaced Christian Eriksen and then, you know, Dele Alli's form dropping off a cliff as well. But you have to look, I think, at the depth in the squad, and we just don't have enough players, I think, that can come on and change a game if it's not going right. I mean, look at the Chelsea this morning, for example. In this morning's game, Tuchel was able to make a triple substitution in the 75th minute and bring on Lukaku, Pulisic, and Ziyech. And, you know, Ziyech is, you know, for me, one of their best players. I'm shocked that he spends as much time as he does on the bench. And at that stage of a game, if we need to shake something up, if it's not clearly not working, our bench is pretty much Moura and Bergwijn and hope for the best, you know? So I think that it's illustrative of the fact that we're putting too much on too few players' shoulders. And again, just going back to the issue we had with the service from the wingbacks, maybe it might just be time to you know, start Moura and Bergwijn as wingbacks and just see what happens. It certainly can't be any worse. But you know, the good news this week, I think, obviously was signing Skip to an extended contract, and I think we're pretty strong in the middle of the park with Bentancur and Højbjerg and Skip as well. But you know, there are certain aspects of our play that if one player's having an off day, usually that can be covered for. If three players are having an off day at the same time, then we're not going to be able to redress that. And especially if that happens against teams who have a very determined game plan, who know how we're going to set out, who know how we're going to play. And both Brentford and Brighton played a very solid game plan against us. Credit to both the teams for frustrating us all day. And, it's worrying. The inconsistency, I think, is more worrying than the fact that we're losing random games, because it's not for a want of trying. It's not like you can point to the players and say they're not trying. It's definitely not that. I think it's just literally we're not able to maintain that confidence that comes from knowing that you're playing with the sort of freedom that we had in the Newcastle game. Not to, you know, use that as an example, but that's pretty much where we want to be every game.
Yeah, I think you make a lot of good points there. On your substitution point, for people that aren't aware of this, the first sub this weekend for Tottenham Hotspur was Davinson Sanchez, because Antonio Conte was so worried about how many set pieces we were conceding and not defending well, just giving Tony three free shots at goal, which fortunately he missed all of to help us get the 1 point. But yeah, very, very much illustrates your point. And it seems Conte isn't super pleased with Bergwijn behind the scenes, because you'd think he'd be the one you'd first turn to. But he did that I deserve to play more thing, where then they were like, prove it, and then you didn't, and so no. And then Lucas always, you know, works as hard as he can, but he has no end output. And then you mentioned the wingback situation, because I think from the second Doherty went down, Tottenham have not been the better side in a match, including the Villa match, which the scoreline did not reflect how that match went. So I think you're totally right. I think Doherty himself provided output. He helped Kulusevski, exactly like you were saying earlier, helps with the crossing for our previous conversation. It means that the person on the left doesn't need to do as much, which Reguilon and Sessegnon are both disappointed in doing. And I think, you know, not that all of a sudden people realize that Kane's good, but Villa basically shaded Kane's right foot the whole match to make sure he couldn't play early balls. Brighton never let Kane get the ball, period. And then this last match, I actually thought was his best of the three in terms of getting the ball, but then he wasn't doing well with it. He was having loose touches, misplacing passes. He just wasn't, air quotes, on. So yeah, there's a lot going on, and none of it is very encouraging in the race for fourth, but we've seen crazier things. And technically, if Tottenham won out, they'd make it in, because they're 2 points off Arsenal, and a win against Arsenal is worth three. I'm looking at the scoreboard. That math checks out. But anyway, we'll move from there into Player Watch, where the bottom of the table is starting to make a little bit more sense. Although I think it was Steve you mentioned earlier that maybe Leeds are getting kind of pulled back into it, which is probably fair. But mostly it's four clubs, right? It's Norwich and Watford who are seemingly down, Burnley and Everton fighting for that last relegation spot, and maybe potentially Leeds if they get dragged into it. And I was just curious if there are any players from those clubs that you're kind of eyeing as potential incomings if they were to go down.
Yeah, I had to think hard about this, because I restricted myself to the teams that I think definitely are down already. So I sort of thought in terms of Watford and Norwich to start with, both of whom have been really disappointing this season, so it was actually really hard to pick a player that I'd quite like to sign from those two. Obviously, Dennis has probably been at Watford, has probably been the standout from an attacking perspective, even if he had kind of gone off the boil a bit in the second half of the season, maybe hasn't maintained that early season form that he did have. But Palace are kind of fairly well stocked in that area already, so I think if I'm thinking in terms of players that would fit an actual need for Palace, then I'd probably say Max Ahrens, the Norwich right back, who has always impressed me whenever I've watched him, even if he did give away a penalty against Palace this season. But we're at a bit of a weird place in that position. Joel Ward is kind of past the peak of his powers. Nathaniel Klein has been good this year, but, you know, similarly is at the wrong end of his career. And then you have Nathan Ferguson, who we signed to fill that void at right back ahead of the, I think it was the 2021 season. But he just seems to have the worst luck with injury. I think he's done his cruciate, he's done his Achilles, and every time he's kind of on the cusp of a return, he seems to tweak a hamstring or do a groin or something like that. And it just kind of feels like he's one of those players who's just destined to never play a game for us, unfortunately. So I think if I had to choose, I would probably say Aaron's at Norwich. But then if you were to get into, you know, some of those other teams down there, like Everton, for example, there's probably quite a few players in that squad that I'm sure a lot of teams, not only Palace, would kind of be looking at and would be interested in signing. Because when you go through that Everton squad, it really is quite remarkable that they are, they do find themselves in the position that they're in.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I was going to mention Ahrens as well, because, not really because we have a fullback, wingback situation to deal with, but also because I think he has always been a good, solid player. And I think apart from Saar, perhaps, and Dennis, as you mentioned, I'm not sure any of the Watford or the other Norwich players would be really anything more than squad additions for us. Not that we, you know, don't need more depth, but we need a greater range of quality. And obviously, you know, a lot's going to depend on who our manager is next season and what they think they might need. That's a good point you made actually about Everton. And I was thinking, you know, if Everton did eventually go down, I think Richarlison could do a good job for us. He has a very sort of Chris Armstrong vibe about how he runs off the ball and he gets into, you know, good attacking positions if he can get good service. And obviously, as you say, Sam, you know, it would be interesting to see where players like Pickford or Doucouré or Alain might go. Still very outside possibility, I think, that Leeds, if Leeds went down, Rafinha would be in demand. And Calvin Phillips, I think, has been obviously loosely linked with us in the past. But I suspect in that situation, bigger clubs than us would probably outbid us for him. I obviously have a soft spot for Stuart Dallas. And his positional flexibility, but, you know, not recommending that we sign him. He would have been a great squad signing, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, and he's just a terrific player for Northern Ireland as well. If Burnley go down, I think Maxwell Cornet will be in big demand, and I also thought Weghorst was a really good pickup for them, but I haven't seen enough of Weghorst really to know if he's the sort of player that would fit in at Spurs, but. Yeah, it's always a challenge, isn't it? Sort of thinking if a player comes from a team that's been relegated, they obviously have something to prove, but they're also there's a reason they were relegated, you know. So it's going to be an interesting way to see how that shakes out.
Yeah, I basically any striker to back up Kane. Richarlison could do it obviously wide and also play through the middle. So kind of in a Son way, not comparing the two as players too much, but just the fact that he could deputize both positions so you aren't bloating the squad trying to find separate players to fix those solutions. But yeah, like give me Emmanuel Dennis. It would be something different than Kane. So yeah, absolutely fine with that. But I do think if you're limiting yourself to those two, I think you're both probably right for picking Max Aarons, who hasn't really lived up to his prospect status as much as I think people would have hoped. But that still makes him probably the best of those clubs, which maybe says a lot. I do really like Sarr, but again, had a kind of a weird year this year, so not really sure if that's someone you want to hang your hat on. Right. All right, Sam, next up for you is the Leeds side that we keep mentioning based on the fact that everybody seems a little iffy on their Premier League status. Are you confident heading into that one?
If you'd asked me this 2 weeks ago, then I definitely would have been. But as you guys have sort of been saying, it feels like tomorrow is taken on what sort of initially felt like would have been sort of a bit of a dead rubber. It feels like it's taken on greater significance, especially for Leeds, I suppose. You know, he almost looked safe a few weeks ago after those wins against, they obviously beat Wolves, that really weird 3-2. I think there was one game before that where they sort of nicked it in the last minute. Norwich, that was it. They won that one in the last minute as well. But because of Burnley's form, especially, as you say, that kind of there is kind of a slight risk of them getting sucked in again. And, you know, everyone talks about the difficulty of Everton's running, but Leeds also still have City, Arsenal and Chelsea to play in theirs. So I imagine that they'll probably be looking at Monday night's game as one where they really need to pick up a point or three just to kind of make sure of their Premier League status. But, you know, similarly for us, I wouldn't say it's a huge game, but it's an important game just to kind of prove that, you know, what we've done this season, just to kind of carry on the progress that we've been making this season, to be honest, because there is a danger of it petering out after the semi-final, the game against Newcastle on the Wednesday after. I didn't manage to watch it, but from what I heard, it was, you know, pretty ordinary from our perspective, which you can kind of accept a few days after such a big game. I imagine the occasion at Wembley probably took a lot out of the players, but I think hopefully tomorrow we can expect a little bit of that hunger to be back, and, you know, just to prove, if anything, that there's always that saying, is that there are certain teams that at this stage of the season kind of down tools a little bit because it's job done. And I've seen Palace do that on far too many occasions, and it really makes the last few weeks of the season not very enjoyable at all. So I'm hoping that under Vieira things will be a little bit different, and we do turn up tomorrow and we sort of get a 3 points that takes us to that magic 40-point mark.
Gotcha. Well, certainly good luck. And then Steve, next up for us is Leicester, which a lot of people probably think is going to be, you know, a close affair. But in recent years, Tottenham versus Leicester has been a lot of goals, and typically for Harry Kane.
Yeah, exactly. Or indeed for Steven Bergwijn, based on the the previous fixture. But I don't think we can expect that sort of drama again this time, although I'd love to be proved wrong if, if it turns out the right way. I mean, it's very typical, isn't it? Of, you know, Spurs and Leicester, both teams that have had Champions League heroics in recent years, and Leicester, you know, still with association with European football and still sort of dabbing at the edges there. But they're, you know, what are they? They're in 11th, 10th, something like that. And, you know, I can see this finishing 0-0 based on the way in which we're playing at the moment and the fact that Leicester aren't really particularly decisive or incisive when it comes to scoring goals at the moment. But, who knows? I mean, it's a tough one. I'm glad it's at home. Let's put it that way. I'm glad we actually get back to playing at home and actually try and pick up some points when we need them. But you know, it could be one of those games that just turns out to be desperately frustrating.
Certainly hope not, but yeah, that's possible. In theory, it should be a good match to get off of this no shots on target thing. But you know, knocking on all sorts of materials, including wood. We'll leave the show there for today. This, if you'd like to tell folks where they could find you or anything you're working on, now would be a good time.
Yeah, cheers, Kev. Cheers, Steve. Always enjoy coming on, and all the best to Spurs in their pursuit of the top four. I'm Sam Karp. You can find me at Sam_Karp on Twitter, and you can also find some of my articles on the Eagles Beak fan site.
Thank you, Kevin. It was another fun conversation. Thank you, Sam. And best wishes to everybody, Jake, and everybody at the Eagles Beak, which is a really good fanzine. My name's Steve McGookin, and you can get me on Twitter at Steve McGookin. And next time I come on, Kev, I'm going to tell you all about this new writing project that I've got going on.
Ooh, exciting. Yeah, I've actually gotten a sneak peek, and people will probably be excited to see what that is when it comes out. And also, Sam, thank you for your kind words about the top four. I wish you a merry finish above Brighton. For the show, you can find us at EPL Roundtable. You can also email us at eplroundtable@gmail.com with any questions. I'm on Twitter at Kev Roth. But thanks to these two massively for coming on today. Had a great time. And folks at home, we hope you keep listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.